Everybody knows what that is, right? Horseflies. They're ubiquitous, they're big, they can be brutal, but they actually, a lot of them are quite mysterious. We don't know a lot about their life history or their taxonomy. In fact, this one is a member of a genus that has over 1,000 species, which is probably not a natural group. Work on horseflies has waned in the last century. It was at the turn of the century, it was really quite, people were really quite interested, especially with medical entomology during the First and Second World Wars, but towards our conflicts in Asia with Vietnam and the like, the focus has shifted towards medical entomology with mosquitoes. But there are a lot of other things that are important about horseflies other than just transmitters of disease. Yeah, they're also important pollinators, and this one is a little more fantastic maybe than most flies because it has a long proboscis and it's found in Africa. This is Phylacia aethiopica, but all horseflies are pollinators. They all, both males and females, require nectar meals in order to power themselves for flight, and only females take blood. This is actually a female Phylacia who also takes blood as well, even though she has a long proboscis. In some work done in Afrotropics in Tanzania, they did a sort of gray paper where they looked at pollen loads on potential pollinators through malaise traps, and they found that tabanids actually had a lot, like I think 10 times more pollen on them than all the butterflies and beetles. And these weren't even flies like this, this is a species of tabanus. They also have a really great morphological and ecological diversity. There are a lot of wasp and bee mimics. They live in tree holes, and a great many of them spend a lot of their life in the canopy, which is why I think we don't know a lot about their biology. So we're lucky in that we were able to get a PEAT grant so that we can try to further research and training specialists in some of the in this group that's lost most of its specialists in the last, I'd say, 15 years. So we'd like to translate the existing knowledge that we can get from the experts and amateurs, if you're out there, we want to talk to you too, into new formats and promote revisionary taxonomy by funding students to work on these groups with modern tools. The PEAT comes out of the NC State University, and we already have three graduate students. One is an honor student at CSIRO, and me as a postdoc working on the grant, and we've received a lot of material from biodiversity projects and also just museums and very generous donors. So if you've got horseflies and you don't want them, we would love to see them. In general, there's over 4,000 species, like I said, and a lot of them are in the subfamily Tabaninae, I think most of them are actually in the genus Tabanus. They have a lot of common names, which is something you tend to see when there's something that's really important, like the number of names Alaskans have for snow. Horseflies, deerflies, clegs, gadflies, greenheads. In South Africa, they call them stabbing flies, a stikvlieg, that's an Afrikaans, or perdebe, which means horse bee, because they look like bees. And there's even a Bushman term that means God's messenger, because they get the cattle moving. And I don't think I can pronounce that click very well, so I won't try. In general, the morphological characters are pretty poor in Tabanidae. They're generally based on head structures and color patterns that are sort of transient, depending on collecting method and preservation. And I think Cheney said it best when he said most patterns are subtle and give an effect that is more easily appreciated by the unaided eye than through a microscope. Genitalia are simple and only occasionally formative below the tribal level, and so I think this really speaks to the importance of molecular data for phylogenetic inference and also for a framework for a revisionary taxonomy. We hope to solve these problems of the poor molecular characters through our work with the PEAT project. So the goal of our collaborative project here is to create a molecular phylogenetic hypothesis as a context for the revisionary studies of the students on the project. So we can make a priority selections of monophyletic groups for revision and provide a framework for morphological character selection and also do some modeling of trait evolution. I just want to give you a quick review of the history of Tabanid phylogeny. It kind of moved around a lot in the early 1800s until everyone settled on Lowe's hypothesis in about 1860, where he divided the family into two subfamilies based on the presence or absence of hind tibial spurs. This turned to be a really poor character. As you can see, the Pangonini on the left there also includes what are known as like deer flies, the Chrysopsini, and then all the sort of the Tibanini that we think of today are in the subfamily Tibanini. Then Macaris came along in 1955 and actually used a cladistic philosophy using genitalia to reorganize the families. And because the ninth tergite of both males and females in the Pangonini is complete and fused, he separated them from Chrysopsini and Tibanini and put them together. So we've got Pangonini as the sister group to Chrysopsini and Tibanini together. The next phylogenetic type cladistic work was done by a Chinese named Wang in 1983, where he was actually the first one to use quantitative techniques to try to understand relationships. He analyzed 10 morphological characters across the subfamilies using four distance techniques, and what my friend who translated this article for me said translated directly to Hennigian apomorphy method. You can see, you don't have to speak Chinese to read down there. It says he's the first method he uses Kluge and Ferris. When he did this, he came up with this hypothesis where actually the Pangonini and the Chrysopsini were together again, but more highly derived than the Tibanini. So he proposed actually to change the subfamily to an actual family named Pangonidae, but no subsequent author has recognized this work or used that designation. Moving on to 2000, Wegman et al. Published 28S phylogeny of the Tibanomorpha with the most extensive molecular sampling of Tibanidae to date. And you can see that they've got the three subfamilies coming out in the relationships predicted by Macaris, with Pangonini sister to the other two groups. In 2008, I published my phylogeny in the Pangonini with outgroup sampling to say something about the Tibanidae relationships of the subfamilies in Tibanidae. And I found similar results, except for no strong support in any of my model-based inference methods for the family Chrysopsini, or the subfamily Chrysopsini. So in this tree, the thick branches represent greater than 90% posterior probability. So Macaris thought that this was going to be a paraphyletic group. We haven't included Skepsidini, which is kind of an odd group only found in South Africa and Brazil. So this is, this is a matrix of our molecular data. We have a protein and nuclear coding genes and ribosomal coding genes, and this is the phylogeny that we got, and what we've got is the Pangonini sister to Chrysopsini and Tibanini, but no real strong support, although it's coming out in this analysis for the Chrysopsini. We also, if you look at where long proboscides come out in this phylogeny, which is an interest to me, they're of course all in the red group there, which is the Pangonini, but they're also within the Chrysopsini and the So I'll be doing a further revision of worldwide of the phylogeny as part of this PEAT project. Daniela Ramirez is going to be looking at Essenbeckia, which is also in the Pangonini, but in the subfamily or the tribe tribe Pangonini. Yeah, and Keith is going to be looking at Dasyucheila and the dichloriniae groups. And he has some really interesting morphological variation that he's looking at there. Really quickly, I just want to show you, we have some new data. We've doubled our molecular matrix so that we have 104 taxa now, but most of the data that we've got is 28S, and so I went ahead and ran 28S only phylogenetic analysis using structural alignment. I'm just going to skip through this, except for I just want to show you quickly that I found three really important areas in the structural alignment where there's variation that has really strong effect on the outcome of the phylogeny. And that's the result there. Not a lot of strong support, because after removing the regions of ambiguous alignment, we've only got 13,000 base pairs. But again, You can see, like, the previous hypothesis was showing support for the Chrysopsony here, but that's almost completely lost in this new data. So I think with that, I'm out of time. Thank you. Okay.
We have time for questions.
Yeah.
So when you include the regions of ambiguous alignment, how does it affect your tree?
It actually strengthens the tree. So the first analysis that we did, it wasn't actually a structural alignment. It was just alignment with clustal with regions that were unalignable by eye cutout. And it actually adds a lot of structure to the tree. What I would like to do is use this Marna method to align these regions of ambiguous alignment, which is it's a recursive structural alignment method. And you can just take these areas of RAAs and paste them into the web page and have them come up with this structural alignment for you. And looking at it, there's actually a lot of information. Like here you can see this is a group of pangolins that these are all in the same genus. This is Mycteromyini and Essenbeckia. And they've got this synapomorphy here in what would be the loop region. And it's pretty clear that it's really informative for the phylogeny. So I really want to be able to put those back in and use them.
Thanks.